This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When it's time for a parent to teach the so-called facts of life, it can be helpful to have a good book addressed to children to help explain this new confusing territory. But let's face it, some of us are still laughing at the absurd books we were given as kids. Now there's a new informative but chatty book called It's a Girl Thing that's addressed to girls who are just beginning puberty. As the author Mavis Jukes says in the opening page, the book talks about breasts, pubic hair, underarm perspiration, and menstruation, bras, deodorant, tampons, pads, sex, sexuality, pregnancy, birth control, and sexually transmitted diseases. Jukes' goal is to introduce crucial information to preteens so that they can make safe choices as teenagers. We're going to have an adult conversation about teaching girls about sexuality, so use your judgment in deciding whether this is appropriate for your children to hear. Mavis Jukes is an elementary school teacher and an award-winning author of books for children and teenagers. Her new book mixes information with a series of personal reminiscences about Jukes' own coming of age and how she learned the facts of life. Here's a reading.
I knew all the basics about womanhood because my mother never locked me out of her bathroom. I was a member of an exclusive organization, the Ladies' Business Club. Most mornings, my mother took a shower, but sometimes she just gave herself a quick sponge bath. Naked, she'd fill the sink and wash her armpits, crotch, and rear with a soapy washcloth. She rinsed herself, carefully wringing out the washcloth, often humming a tune. A few days each month, after she had bathed and dried off, my mother climbed into a thin elastic belt. She turned it around so there was one hook in the front and one in the back. Then she hooked a big white pad onto the clips. Next, she put on a garter belt. Then she put on cotton underwear and pulled the garters, which were attached to elastic ribbons, down through the leg holes. She attached stockings, which had seams up the back, to the garters. She bent over when she fastened her bra so her breasts were in the right place when she stood up. She then pulled a slip over her head and put on a blouse and buttoned it. She stepped into a skirt and zipped it up the side. She put on high-heeled shoes, then she brushed her hair. Finally, she put on perfume and lipstick, earrings and beads or a pin. Later, if I happened to walk into the bathroom when it was time for my mom to change her pad, she wouldn't even seem embarrassed. She would just sit on the pot, chatting about this or that. I would watch with interest as she unhooked the pad from the elastic belt, front and back, rolled it up, wrapped it in newspaper, and threw it into the trash. Then I would hand her a new pad out of the box in the bathroom cupboard. She would attach it to the hooks on the elastic belt. Sometimes she would sprinkle on a little deodorant powder, which came in a small tin can.
Mavis Jukes, I think so many people will think back to their childhood hearing that passage, that so many daughters grew up watching their mothers and learning that way. And, you know, having you read that passage made me realize how long ago our childhoods must seem to girls today. Even the fact that there were no maxi pads with adhesives back then, that you had to wear, you know, belts to hook the sanitary napkins onto.
Right, and no winged pads and no pads with Velcro.
Now, it's interesting. Obviously, your mother wasn't shy about her body around you, and you learned a little bit about menstruation watching your mother. Was your mother also comfortable talking to you about the, quote, facts of life, about anything sexual?
Well, no. I mean, it was like the mid-50s, and, you know, the facts of life were really delivered to all of us in three or four sentences, always followed up with, well, if you have any questions, just ask. And then, of course, you know, we couldn't think of any questions, and there was so little information given, I didn't even know what to ask about, really. But we mainly found out about that from our friends. A lot of the misinformation was passed around through our friends.
Your new book is a book for young people about sex and intercourse and puberty and all the things that go along with that. What books did you have to explain the facts of life when you were a girl?
Well, actually, there weren't many around. There was one that I remember called Now You Are 10. But then sometimes the companies that made sanitary napkins, like Modest, for example, would put out these little brochures that would give the basics about having a period. And I remember clearly that the explanation about sex in the books was about human reproduction, actually. It went something like this. After this egg is fertilized, it grows into a little embryo, and then it turns into a fetus, and then into a baby, and then the baby is born. And I remember searching back through those brochures or that book over and over again, thinking, what is with the fertilizer? Why is the fertilizer not mentioned, and what is it? And then how the baby was born was also equally a mystery, like where did it come out? Because I, for one, was totally unaware of the fact that I even had a vagina, and I couldn't imagine where a baby might get out except possibly through the belly button. But those were the books that were available, ones that basically talked about periods and then sort of skipped the sex part and talked about giving birth without giving any details.
I remember in a book that I was given, and the word inserted was used, and I think inserted was used in a lot of these books about, you know, the penis was inserted into the vagina. And you'd think that maybe you needed like a T-square or, you know, other like carpentry tools to make this work. The language was just so technical.
Maybe so, but you were lucky that they even referred to the penis in your book. I mean, you know, I must be quite a bit older than you are, because in mine, there was no mention of male body parts. It was all just kind of carefully skipped over.
So the literature that you had, the pamphlets and the books, weren't very helpful. They just left you with a lot of questions like, well, what is the fertilizer?
Right, exactly. So
how did you really get the story on this? Did your mother give it to you? Did you learn it from other kids?
Absolutely not. I'll never forget it as long as I live. You know, the phone rang, and the conversation went like this. My first name is Dorothy, and kids, when I was young, used to call me Dottie. So it was like, Dottie, Maureen. And it was my new friend, Maureen Amersano, who'd moved from the city to the country where I lived. And then it went something like, did you know that to get a baby, a man puts his you-know-what into the woman's you-know-what? And then, you know, I said something like, well, of course I knew that, and then quickly hung up the phone. But of course, I didn't know that, and I wasn't even sure what a woman's you-know-what was. I'm pretty sure what a man's you-know-what was, but so I immediately called everyone I knew and casually told them the same information.
Now, when you first learned the facts of life, you learned what was required for procreation. Did you have any clue that sex not only led to babies, but that it was pleasurable, that there was such a thing as sexual pleasure?
No. I didn't even really, basically, that's a great question, because basically looking back, I didn't even know that sex had anything to do with anything. I just thought that this, you know, the act of sexual intercourse or the act of intercourse was to get a baby. And the sex part of it didn't even enter into the equation for me. I just figured something people had to put up with doing if they wanted to have a family.
You know, I think it's sometimes very disturbing to girls when they learn about childbirth. I mean, as kind of confusing and shocking as sex seems when you first find out about it, childbirth is that way too. And I think girls wonder, how can a baby possibly fit through this part of their body that they may not even have known existed, and that is obviously really small. And I think you deal with that in a really amusing and sensitive way. You want to discuss that a little bit? First of all, you have ouch written
right
in these large letters across the page, acknowledging that this might be a real surprise to you. How does your body accommodate this infant?
Right. Well, one of the things that I mentioned is, you know, the question of how a baby will fit out of an opening that small, you know, that's a question I continued to ask myself throughout my pregnancy. As an adult, it's a very, very good question. And really the answer to the question is, ouch. You know, we all know that our body, you know, our hips move and shift and things change to make it easier for a child to pass through the birth canal. But honestly, I mean, anybody can put two and two together and figure out that it's a tight squeeze. So I just told the girls the truth about it.
You know, in your book, you write a little bit about your own experiences when you were learning about sexuality and childbirth and when you were going through puberty. And you write about how desperately you wanted a bra.
Yeah.
And what it was like to shop for that first bra. Reminisce for us a little bit why that was such a powerful experience, why you wanted one so badly.
I just ached for a bra. I just yearned and longed for a bra. You know, there's never anything I wanted more in my life except for possibly a horse.
What did it mean to you?
It must have meant some kind of symbol of power, that I was growing up, that I was, you know, becoming an adult or something. But mainly it was just that I loved the idea of having a bra. And I really, really didn't need one. I had actually planned to have very large breasts when I grew up. And I just, you know, was just banking on that. And it was hard sort of waiting for that to happen. In fact, it never happened. But when I was... even 10 years old or 11, was just simply nothing to put in a bra. I really wanted one. And when I told the story in the book of how I would practice asking my mom in my mind, could I have a bra? And the words would just never come out. And that suddenly the words kind of tumbled out one day and we went and shopped for one. And I will truly never forget just the smell of that bra when I took it out of the box. It just smelled so delicious.
Now, I remember on assembly days, which I think were twice a week in my grade school, you had to wear a white shirt. And you could see beneath the white shirt whether a girl was wearing an undershirt or a bra. And it started to become really important that when someone looked beneath that white shirt that you were wearing a mature bra and not a kid undershirt.
Absolutely.
Did you go through that?
No, but if there had been an assembly day at my school where I was required to wear a white shirt, I'm sure that I would have popped the question to my mother way earlier than that, because I really wanted to be in a leadership position in all ways when I was a kid, including, you know, first with the bra, first with the period, and so on. Now, I was out of luck with my period because I didn't start my period till I was 14 years old, but I was able to find a way around that, which was that I just lied about it to my friends and, you know, said that I had started months before I'd actually really started. And I kind of counseled them about their periods and so on, and told them to be patient if they hadn't started yet. But that assembly day thing, why did you have to wear a white shirt?
Oh, for the same reason we had to wear a red tie and a blue skirt. I mean, you know, who can understand these things? My guest is Mavis Jukes, author of It's a Girl Thing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mavis Jukes. Her new book, It's a Girl Thing, is a guide for preteens to puberty and sexuality. Jukes teaches at an elementary school and holds lunchtime sessions with girls in which she covers some of the same territory as her book.
I'm paired up with another teacher, a woman, a sixth grade teacher. And what we did is we started out by sending out parent permission slips and giving an overview of what the program would be at lunchtime. And then the girls whose parents approved were allowed to come for an hour once a week or 45 minutes once a week. And we ate lunch together and we just sat in a big circle. And we talked about a lot of the things that are in the It's a Girl Thing book, not every last thing that's in the It's a Girl Thing book, because I do have to follow the guidelines of the particular school district that I work in. But it was just a really wonderful experience because we got to do things that most people would just not really think of doing, like having a pad festival where I brought, you know, Velcro pads and maxis and minis and slims and you know, ones that pop open like pup tents and overnighters. And I just had hundreds of pads there. And we just kind of let the girls prowl through them. And pretty soon they were doing experiments, like seeing how much apple juice they could pour into one pad and that kind of thing. And it was just truly exhilarating. And we just wanted it to be all girls because we just felt that it would just be more relaxed. And I actually think it's a good idea for girls and boys to be separated for sex ed classes in school. But anyway, questions would come up and we answered them and we just had a fine time.
Mavis Jukes, you write books for young people. You are a mother as well, and I know you don't like to publicly discuss the lives of your children in order to protect their privacy. But I'm wondering if there's anything you can tell us about what was most problematic for you as a mother when you were trying to convey to your children the facts about sexuality and reproduction.
Well, I can tell you very truthfully that it was not problematic, but it's not because, you know, I had any, unusually close relationship with my kids in regards to the material in this book. It's because they both had excellent human interactions classes in public school. And, you know, they were coming home with notes and worksheets and information and so on that, you know, I was learning stuff from. So I never really had any questions. Very reassuring that they were actually getting a lot of accurate information from school. And I would like to take a moment to add that many parents have conveyed to me a sense of distress sometimes, that they would like to discuss things more with their kids, but their kids don't seem to really want to talk that much. And I really honor that. I really respect that. And I understand that not all kids really want to talk to their parents about these issues, and I certainly didn't. And I ask people sometimes, well, when was the last time you felt like sitting down with your parents and you know, having a good talk about sex? And, of course, it's just a preposterous thought for most people, but some people do. I think it's rather usual for both parents and kids to feel some amount of reservations about talking about a lot of the stuff that's in this book. It's kind of a private read, really.
I think it probably says a lot about what young people are up against now to mention that your book includes these really delightful, funny stories about your first bra and the first time you started menstruating. And there's all kinds of, like, really well-given information about sex and puberty and so on. And in the same book, you caution young people about HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy and so on. And I mean, obviously, it's sex is both is potentially life threatening for young people now.
True.
And I guess, you know, you want to be careful that you're not scaring young people too much about sex, so that they're too afraid to ever enjoy it. You know what I mean? You don't want young people to grow up with this fear that will never go away. On the other hand, you want them to grow up really cautious and careful and responsible. Tell me a little bit about what balance you tried to strike in your book.
Well, the balance that I tried to strike in the book is remembering again that the book is for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade girls, I tried to really emphasize the importance of postponing having sex.
How do you do that?
Just kept on saying, you know, well, how do you do it? Really, the way I did it, and the way I think it really can and should be done, is to tell the kids the truth about the risks that are associated with having sex when you're too young to be able to assume the responsibilities of a sexual relationship. And you know, there are emotional risks as well as physical risks. And studies show that the more kids know about sex and the more parents talk to kids about sex, the more likely they are to postpone having sex for a long time, especially in this age group, which is way too young for anyone to be engaging in sex with a partner, in my view. You just can't say, just don't do it. Just give kids the actual factual information and also clue them in on as to some of the responsibilities when they do reach a point in their lives where they're sexually engaged, you know, seeing an OBGYN doctor, family planning issues, types of birth control, and, of course, above all, latex condoms and safer sex issues. But in addition to the issues around sex in this book, there's also a huge section on assault prevention, which I worked very hard on. And I will say that this book was really a hard book to write. Yes, there's those great lighthearted stories about first bras and first periods and sticking dimes in Kotex machines, but then it had to, you know, I needed to weave those stories into with other information that kids are entitled to know. And I think it is simply critical that kids, including teens, be completely aware of all the issues around potential sexual assault and who to call, who to talk to, where to go, how to prevent it, how to recognize it. I've noticed in schools over the last 5 or 10 years that there's been a big emphasis on educating kids about stranger danger and so forth. But when you consider the fact that like 85% of all sexual assault of children and and young teens is perpetrated by someone known to them, known to the family, often in a position of trust. See, sometimes we don't give the kids enough information. And I really tried in this book to just be very direct about, you know, the potential of what's out there and how kids can protect themselves from that.
Just one more thing, something I find really interesting about your book. The only books that I've ever seen, you know, Facts of Life type books, aren't written with a point of view. They always seem to be written in this omniscient narrator point of view by nobody in particular, the way textbooks are, just by this omniscient presence. And yours is the first one I've seen, maybe I've missed the others, you know, where it's a point of view where you're telling something about yourself and sharing information. And I think that's an interesting way of doing it.
Well, thank you for noticing that. I wanted the book to read kind of like, you know, a favorite aunt talking to you. I just wanted it to seem, well, it's true, though. I'm not everybody's favorite aunt, but I'm very dedicated to youth and educating youth. And I just feel that having it be this type of a book where it's not some distant voice, but instead just a real person out there just telling you what happened to her, I just felt comfortable with doing it that way, and it seems to have worked.
Well, Mavis Jukes, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on the program. I've really enjoyed it.
Mavis Jukes' new book is called It's a Girl Thing. She's the author of several other books for children and teenagers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.